I knew Mike Stace actually for a while before I joined this running group that he was starting, and it was called the Bridge Runners. To fast forward, I ran with him for 7 years, probably never missing a day. Like I don't remember ever missing a Wednesday in the 7 years I ran with Bridge Runners. And a few of us would show up, and then we would go run in the dark over the bridge into Brooklyn, and then go through some weird neighborhoods, and then run back. And it actually felt really sketchy at the time. And sketchy stuff would happen sometimes. Like people would chase us. There was definitely a point where somebody like ran, like was running next to me and like tried to trip me. It was weird stuff would happen back then, but it was always exciting. And I was really one of the only girls that was kind of a part of this group in the beginning.
I'm Trey.
I'm Quest.
And we're your hosts. Each week, we'll seek out and interview the heroes that live amongst us.
And each week, we'll ask them to tell us the story of an adventure that challenged them, stuck with them, and forced them to grow.
This is our truest adventure.
I have a background in fine arts and also in psychology. And I went to get my master's in art therapy, which in New York State, it's a licensed profession similar to social work or mental health counseling or like marriage and family counseling. So what you do is you study in New York, you study psychotherapy. So I'm, like certified in psychotherapy, but using art as part of the therapy process. So it can be used for diagnostic purposes and primarily used for treatment.
Oh, wow. And is there a particular demographic that you work with?
Yes. So I love teenagers. I've been working with young adults and teenagers for about 20 years. Before I became an art therapist, I was a teaching artist and been working in social justice for almost 20 years. I work with young people. I'm currently on a grant in a high school in Brooklyn.
Oh, man, that's amazing.
Yeah.
What was it that brought you to that?
Honestly, people talk to me about art therapy when I was probably coming out of high school. But I didn't know what it was at the time. And I really wasn't like listening to other people's advice. I was kind of like, stubborn, strong-willed young lady. So, I just went off to art school and decided I just wanted to go pursue art making. And when I got there, I ended up getting involved in a program called the Prison Creative Arts Project, which was it's a pretty large organization that's based in Michigan, but it was started by two professors at the University of Michigan. And basically they place artists and writers and actors into different settings around Michigan, whether it's maximum security prisons or detention centers. I worked in a couple of different homes for youth that were, for one reason or another, they were, involved in the criminal justice system. And so I started teaching art classes to kids that were living in the group homes. And I got involved in it randomly. It was like a class that I stumbled on that sounded interesting to me, and it just kind of shifted my path to start working as a teaching artist. When I graduated from school, I started working at a detention center in Detroit, and I was working with kids who were waiting to go to court. So they were basically incarcerated, but waiting to go through their court process. And there was a charter school inside of the detention center. And so I started teaching art there. And there was an art therapist there. And so kind of brought it back to what people told me before, which is they said they thought I would be good at art therapy. I saw what he was doing. It was really pretty powerful. Like, the kids really loved the time that they had to make art. And so I ended up deciding I was going to study art therapy and looked at moving to San Francisco. There was a school I wanted to study at out there. Ended up getting waitlisted at that school and instead getting into NYU. And so I moved to New York in 2003. And then started on my path to being an art therapist. So always loved helping people and been really like social justice oriented, and art therapy. Also was an artist myself. Was pretty avid at doing art in high school. And so, it just made sense to me.
And Jesse, I want to say first, like, don't feel bad about that California school waitlisting you. Uh-huh. I'm still on the waitlist for Stanford Law School. And even though I've been out of law school for almost 10 years now, if I get that letter saying that they'll let me come, I'm going to start over and go back.
You're going to start over?
I will start over. I wanted so badly to go to Stanford Law School, you would not believe. And yeah. I still haven't gotten official word that I did not get in. The last letter I got from them was that I was waitlisted.
Yeah. Yeah. They never follow up, right?
It's, yeah. Like, what is that about? Like, we don't have feelings.
It's a process, man. It's a process.
Maybe the wait list just stays open.
Yeah.
Keep waiting.
It's like taking true to term, right? Wait list. That is what I've been doing for about 13 years.
You're showing them that you're a good listener.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they want to see how patient you are.
Yeah. So it's interesting to me because it's just like, so here you are in high school and somebody goes, art therapy, and you're like, nah, later.
Right.
And then it comes back around when you're in a prison or a detention center in Detroit where it's like, oh, hey, just art therapy here to remind you that this is your calling.
Right.
But you said in all of that, the thing that kind of caught my ear was you said that you were an artist. Do you not create art anymore? No?
No, I still do. And I think that I still consider myself an artist. But it's interesting when you go down the path of art therapy or even art education, as a lot of my colleagues and friends have, your art making definitely takes a back burner, and it's just like an occupational hazard because you're spending so much time really focusing on helping other people create that it kind of takes away from your time for your own creative process. So the work that I was doing for a long time, I love to paint, and I was doing really large scale portraits of people. And I've kind of gotten away from that a bit. One, when you move around a lot and also living in New York City, space is a commodity. So it was harder to make really large scale work living in tiny apartments.
And you say large scale, like how big are you talking about, Jesse?
What?
When you say large scale, how big are you talking about?
I mean, some of them would be maybe like 4 feet by 6 feet.
So really large.
Yeah, like pretty big paintings. And it's one, it's hard to move those around and then store them. And it starts to feel a little bit impractical when you're moving around a bunch. So I've kind of shifted my creative process a bit. I take a lot of photos. And I guess the way that I see it is that art making is always going to be there for me, but it's going to kind of evolve with my lifestyle. And I feel that way about running also. Like running and art making are kind of two big parts of my life, and I think they're always evolving around the needs of where I'm at as a person. So I still feel that I create things every day, but it's not quite the same process.
Got it. And so you mentioned running being the other big part of your life. As you know, this season of the Truest Adventure is centered around Truest Adventures and running. Mm-hmm. So how long have you been a runner? Like as a start, like were you a runner in junior high school in terms of on sports teams, or when did you first start running?
Yeah. So my family's super athletic. And you know, my dad, actually my mom too, was like a tomboy growing up, which I just found out recently from her sister. I was at a family reunion and I didn't realize my mom was like as active as she was, which I think is interesting because she had me in 79. So she would have been in her 20s, like in the mid 70s, which is like when things change for women as athletes. And that was kind of around the time where women were fighting for equal opportunities to be like in the marathon, like the Boston Marathon, or to have their own sporting events or even their own sports teams in college. So my mom was super athletic. My dad was too. I think he was like a decathlete in high school or something. And a bunch of my brothers played like Division I soccer in college. And so
athletic family is an understatement.
Yeah. I think we were just always, it's really normal to always be running around playing sports, like all of the time. If you look at any photographs from my childhood, it's like us playing t-ball in the front yard, or my dad would mow like a softball field into the backyard. He would like mow the grass down lower to make the baselines. We'd host like big kickball events in the neighborhood. So we were always like really actively running around. I was one of those kids who had a skinned knee all of the time. Like both of my knees were always green from grass stains on clothes. So by the time I made it to junior high school where there were like, sports teams, the first team I joined was a track team. And, I, you know, figured out that I had an aptitude for sprinting. And so I ran the 100, I ran the 100 meter hurdles, the 200, the 4x1, 4x2. So those were like my events. And then I also was super into volleyball. So track and volleyball, it became like a toss up for me. At one point my parents were like, you got to choose one. Like, you can't do both sports. You have to have one that you're going to do. So I chose volleyball was the one I really wanted to focus on. And then somehow there was like, I think I really argued my way into being able to still do track. So I never had to give up the other sport, even though they like kind of threatened that I would. And I guess, you know, I always ran from that point on, but I never considered myself someone that could run really any more than 200 meters. Like that felt like a lot to me.
Yeah. So when you had like the skill as a sprinter, and that's like mostly what, that's what all your events were, right?
Yeah. I remember they tried to get me to do the 400 and I was like, no way. It's way too far.
It's too far. Not doing it.
It's too far. And what's interesting is, so, I mean, we just recently met, what was it? That was beginning of this month, actually, in April. And so now, like, I'm following you on Instagram and I know that you just ran Boston.
Yes.
And so you go from not wanting to run 400 because it's too far. Yeah. So now it's 26.2. What is the progression getting from there to there?
Yeah. It's kind of weird because, and I meet a lot of sprinters, like adults now who are sprinters. And I think we all have the same mindset, which is at first you're like, there's no way I could run distance. Especially if you watched your friends run like middle distance. In high school or college, and it just seemed like they were murdering themselves all the time to do like the 1500, and then like making the jump to like, okay, now I'm gonna run 3 miles or 4 miles. I think, you know, when you first do it, it feels really weird because you're just, one, you haven't trained to run like that. And, two, maybe physically it feels terrible. I know when I first started running distance, it was like, I would do a mile and I would run it as hard as I could. And I just felt like that was it. Like I gave it everything. To me, that was like running distance.
Funny. Cause Whitney, who we had on, also was a sprinter in high school, gets the scholarship to LSU and all that. And her talking about her running now, it's like the same thing.
Yeah.
She just, whatever the distance is, she's just trying to run it as hard as she possibly can.
Yes.
And said repeatedly, I am never doing a marathon. I'm definitely not doing any more half marathons. And she's like done two.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really hard because the mindset and the way that you've like, I guess your ability to run fast is just so, it's so singular minded, you know, it's just about like being strong and like running as fast as you can. So being able to change your body to do endurance running, it's possible and like we can do it. And I was actually talking to this guy from Toronto, in Boston, and he was a Muay Thai fighter for like 12 years. And he said he had to stop doing Muay Thai because the running and the Muay Thai did not complement each other because he needed to be explosive for Muay Thai. Yeah. And with endurance running, you're not being explosive. You need to be able to train yourself for endurance, which is really saving energy and, you know, using it over a period of time. So, and I felt the same way with sprinting, which is that once you learn how to develop endurance, you kind of lose that other aspect that you had before. It's like you have to choose one or the other. So I feel like I'm pretty good at endurance, which I think you get better at when you're older. At least that's what I've read. At this point, though, it's like, you know, you sacrifice speed for endurance. So it feels different. It's definitely, sometimes I feel like I can't believe I'm actually doing it. It's cool. I think a lot of it is just getting older too.
Yeah. There's like a good analogy to be made for going from sprinting to endurance long distance, along with the same pace of like getting older in life. Right.
Yeah.
To try to stretch a lot of moments and things out as you get older. And it's like the same thing. Like
I notoriously was like on the track team for like a week. And then I was like, this is just running. This sucks. I don't want to do this anymore. So I quit. But now I like got into running in my mid 20s and like same thing, was like struggled to do a mile, would try to do it as fast as I could. Even when I first started to get into any sort of serious distance running, like 2.5 years ago after I moved to New Orleans, it was still very much this idea of, okay, 10Ks are my thing. I'm going to just try to run this as fast as I physically can.
Yeah.
And it's like half marathon, you start training. You could get to that point, but going from doing 10Ks to half marathons, you don't want to start out training with that, trying to run that as fast as you physically can. You
right.
have to switch that mindset, like you were talking about, to just like, okay, I'm going to have to slow down so I can go longer.
Yep.
And so you've been really just, I mean, the whole time we've been talking, you've been incredibly humble. And the reason I say that is because when I met you, we were in DC. And I'm sure you met Quest there as well, but I can only speak for myself. And I heard people like kind of whispering about you. And I mean, we should just preface with the fact that we were in DC for BTG DC, which a lot of our listeners already know is Bridge the Gap. And so some of our listeners have probably started to do some investigating and figured out a little bit more about BTG and might even know who you are. But when we were in DC, you know, you consistently hear people talk about you being one of the originals, the first lady of running, all of these different things. And you haven't mentioned any aspect of that in your life for running. So I'm just going to have to ask the questions here.
Yeah.
How did you become AKA the first lady of running, which is a nickname that, like I said, multiple people threw around when we were in DC. I don't know if they say it in front of you, but they definitely say it around you when you're in the room, especially like some newbies like myself. They're like, do you know who that is? And I was like, no. And then they were like, that's Jesse. I was like, what? That's Jesse.
Yeah. And to add to it, right? And tell me if I've got this wrong. The lore. Tell me if I've got the lore wrong, Jesse. The first lady of running comes from Charlie Dark, who, along with Mike Sayers, is like the godfather of urban running in terms of like the BTG movement. So for them to W that is even, it's like even more impressive.
Yeah. Well, thank you. So I guess just to say that that nickname, comes from Charlie Dark. And I started distance running. So to talk about how I got to that point, I knew Mike Sace actually for a while before I joined this running group that he was starting, and it was called the Bridge Runners. And I had been, when I was in grad school in New York, I was bartending at this like kind of cafe restaurant downtown. And it was definitely like a real like hub for artists and musicians and filmmakers and creatives. It's like a kind of hole in the wall place. And right catty corner to the place was this huge, like old abandoned building that was, it's now like the wealthiest like area you could be in. But at that point it was like this abandoned building and it was covered in graffiti. So it was like a place where a lot of street artists would always be tagging. And Sace lived on that block. And so I would see him all the time. He came in like a bunch because he knew some of the other folks that I worked with. And so I would always see him either he'd be coming into the cafe I was at, or I would see him out at the nightclub. I actually happened to be like best friends with this girl whose husband at the time was like a nightlife promoter. And so we were always, we'd get off of work and we would always hang out for a while and then go clubbing. And so that was like a pretty regular thing. This is probably 2003, 2004. And Sace is a big club guy. So I would see him all the time. And he just kept popping up. And I remember he was like, oh, I have this. I'm starting a run club. And if you come, you could probably get a pair of shoes. I was like, I remember that being the hook. And
Jesse, will you, I just love the way that like you telling us all of this is flowing, but I realize like, as I'm hearing this, like I don't have a good concept of, and I'm sure our folks listening don't have a good concept of, in this space of time when Mike's talking about, I'm starting a run club and you could get free shoes. Yeah. What was like the state of the like running game or run club game in New York at the time?
Okay, good point. So one, urban running was like not a thing. It didn't exist. And two, it was run clubs were like the Central Park Track Club or the Dashing Whippets or like a group of runners who were most likely ran in college and were maybe competitive adults who did races. You know, New York Roadrunners has been around forever. And so there's lots of road running clubs that kind of are associated with New York Roadrunners. So, and there also was like a Nike run club. It was called something else at the time. But it was very different. The way I always describe it is that people who belong to most run clubs were like quote unquote traditional runners. And so it was probably not high school sprinters, but more likely people who ran cross country and folks who were really considered themselves like core runners. So
you're saying there were probably not a lot of club kids and a lot of artists and cafe workers?
No, not at all. And to be honest, like I think you might see runners in Central Park or Prospect Park or maybe like along the West Side Highway, but you wouldn't see them just running around like on the street. I think that was not like a visual that I remember seeing back then. So, honestly, like I would get up and go run in Prospect Park because I lived in Brooklyn. And I'd go out by myself in my sweatpants, sweatshirt, and I think I was running in like Air Maxes or something crazy.
Perfect for running.
Perfect for running. I think I also ran in I ran in shocks.
Nike. Oh, come on.
I did. And yeah, so I had some fitness under my belt when he was mentioning this run club that he was thinking of. So I was like, okay, maybe I could do it. And I would not have considered myself a runner at the time. I never would have went to like a run club if somebody invited me. Like I would have been really intimidated. But because this guy who I always saw out at the nightclub who didn't look fit at all was inviting me to the run club, I felt less intimidated. I was like, oh, I could, okay, I'll try it.
Which is amazing as a thought, right? Like I laugh because it just sounds funny, but like that's part of Mike's thing, right?
Yeah.
That's part of like the origin story of why he was trying to create what he was trying to create, right?
Yes. Yes. Like, and he was a regular guy. And later, you know, to fast forward, I ran with him for 7 years, probably never missing a day. Like, I don't remember ever missing a Wednesday in the 7 years I ran with Bridge Runners.
Wow.
And I, you know, over time, like, found out that he originally, before he'd even started the run group, had been doing workouts with like this other guy, Ed Lovelace, who was like a former pro athlete, and he was like training. He did some training with us on the track, but he was training like Q-Tip and Sace and my other friend, Diane Martel, who's like who directed all the Wu-Tang videos. So it was like, these were the guys that were like getting together to like learn how to run and like become fit, like down in the Lower East Side. So it was, Bridge Runners was like, I think, attractive to me because it was kind of like, it felt really New York. It was really dark, kind of strange. We met on a track in Chinatown that was like really weird scene. And then, you know, a few of us would show up and then we would go run in the dark over the bridge into Brooklyn and then go through some weird neighborhoods and then run back. And it actually felt really sketchy at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, sketchy stuff would happen sometimes. Like, people would chase us. It was definitely a point where somebody like ran, like was running next to me and like tried to trip me. You know, it was weird stuff would happen back then, but it was always exciting. And I was really one of the only girls that was kind of a part of this group in the beginning. So, ultimately I became a pacer for the group. And then we had a leadership team and it was myself and Sace, Cedric Hernandez. And at the time, my boyfriend was one of the other leaders of the group. And then he ended up leaving and then Knox came in. And so it was the four of us. Yeah.
And for people listening, can you tell them who Knox is and like kind of some more of that story now?
Yeah, sure. So, so what ended up happening was that I ended up leaving Bridge Runners to start another group called Black Roses. And, I did it with Knox Robinson, who's, still the coach of Black Roses. We started that group in 2012, after a bunch of things had happened, after we had created Bridge the Gap, which is the very first one that happened in Berlin. This actually in the same calendar year came back, did a bunch of stuff, and then, decided to spin off and do Black Roses. And my original, plan, the reason why I kind of got to the point of Black Roses was that I had been just building up this group of women within Bridge Runners. And we had trained for the Nike Women's Marathon. And I had I was holding a training group of seven women. And I think one of them had done a marathon before, but everyone else was like brand new to marathoning. So we like trained them through the summer to do this marathon. And through that experience, I just realized, I mean, like a lot of stuff. I had been with Bridge Runners for 7 years. And I saw things that I would have been interested to do differently. And the main thing was that I was really interested in providing a training experience for people. And Bridge Runners is more of, it's really more of just like an event, like mm-hmm. the weekly Wednesday runs with them. There's new people that show up each time. It's always, you know, it's like pretty exciting, but, it's not that you're like training people or like building off of that necessarily. Like if mm-hmm. people want to train, they have to go do that elsewhere. That weekly run is more about like socializing and running.
Gotcha.
We created Black Roses because I wanted to make a training group for non-traditional runners. And so the idea was to actually provide kind of a really structured training environment for people, and that we would run it on seasons. So people would have to commit to a season and train with us, and then we would give them goal races to race. It was like a departure from Bridge Runners. Other stuff happened along the way that kind of made it bittersweet. It was not like the happiest of partings, because I think originally it was supposed to be like Black Roses was going to be like a women's group, and it was still going to be like BR, like Bridge Runners, Black Roses BR, and that we would kind of be like a little spin-off of the group. But I wanted it to be like totally separate. And so that was like, it's kind of a bittersweet departure from Bridge Runners. But,
and can I ask, Jesse, and certainly like with you saying that it was a bittersweet departure, if this is like stuff you don't want to talk about, tell us that, we'll move on.
Yeah.
But in terms of like your the original space or where the original idea was to have a spinoff group, just women's group, then shifting it to be, I think ultimately like Black Roses when you guys created it and what it exists as now is men and women, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk to us a little bit about like what was the shift or the thought process that made you say, you know what, we'll open it up. It's not just going to be a ladies run crew and we're going to include dudes, or how, what are the changes? Like, I guess beyond just also including dudes, like what other changes or things did you change from what might've been like the original thought process behind it?
Well, I think what it was that I agreed to compromise, and I wanted it to be all women. Knox was like, let me throw a couple of bros in there so we can train. And I was like, well, okay, we could do that. But then if we're going to do that, I want it to be more women than men, because one of the things that I really felt strongly about was that the urban running scene as it had been developing at that time was very male centric, and there weren't a lot of women leaders, or no women leaders really. I think I was like the only one, and there, you know, there was some stuff going on that was like a little misogynist, and women kind of feeling like uncomfortable in certain situations, like they were being harassed, or there were a few things that happened. And so I wanted Black Roses to be a space where women kind of felt like they could train and not be worried about being hit on, or you know, feel like lesser than because they're not super fast, which sometimes happens in running groups. So yeah, it was kind of like Knox and I like compromised, and I was like, all right, we'll let some guys in, but it's gotta be more women than men. Because I just wanted that dynamic to be kind of balanced. And so it did start out with 15 women, and I think we had 10 men. And I think ultimately what happened was, we were really successful, and, you know, people, we were getting like a lot of like media attention, We were getting a lot of kind of attention from the fashion world, and
what do you think? You know, what do you think that was owed to?
I think part of it was, you know, Knox's background. He worked in music and art. He was like an editor at Fader for a long time.
Oh, gotcha.
Okay. So like he had, between him and I, like, I think we like executed what we were doing at a time when Instagram was brand new also. So like social media was kind of new, Instagram was new, and we were able to kind of talk about what we were doing from the lens of like art and fashion and lifestyle. Right. And so we were like kind of creating this like team of adults that were training, but we also sort of like hand selected people that we thought would make a good balance with each other. And then, you know, we just worked with like good photographers and videographers. And then Knox does he's an amazing storyteller. So he did a great job of kind of like telling the story on social media. So it was weird because we kind of like, we captured a moment in time where we kind of emerged into running culture as something really different. Because we weren't, it was non-traditional, but it was in some ways like paying homage to traditional ideas about training. So it was cool. I mean, it was like our first year was like a lot of work. It was a tremendous amount of work. We were training people 3 days a week. And uh-huh. Yeah, and racing, like our seasons were 6 months and we were racing like internationally. Like I think our first goal race was in Puerto Rico and we went down as a team and kind of like just stunted in Puerto Rico. It was like it was pretty crazy. And we also had like a really eclectic group of people running with us, and I think Black Roses is still, you know, this really diverse group, and people coming from, like, a lot of the runners are, like, creatives, coming from a lot of different backgrounds, so.
Yeah, and, well, and, like, so two things. On that point, that's obvious, because when we were in D.C., this was, like, of course, Trey and I are captains, and he's co-founder of the our New Orleans Bridge the Gap crew, 504th. So mm-hmm. We're babies in the game. In DC, what we realized when we got there is like, this is also an opportunity for all the crews from everywhere to stunt. And most of what the discussion was about for us was like, we need better swag because everybody kept talking about the Black Roses singlets. Like, oh, and yeah. This isn't like us, the babies talking about it. I mean, Bridge Runner cats were like, nah, man, do you see the Black Roses singlet? That joint has foiled gold on it. Da, 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 da. So it's like super dope. But and so the second thing I wanted to ask you about now, making kind of a transition, right? So you talked about that idea of compromising with Knox on the formulation or the foundation of Black Roses.
Yeah.
But your original thought being you wanted to create this safe space for female runners to be in the urban running scene that would like set aside or put them in a safe space not to worry about some of the issues that you'd seen or experienced previously. And so I know now that you're not running with Black Roses anymore at this time, right? And you've started something new.
Yeah. So, yes, excellent transition. So when I decided to leave that project, it was because I said, you know what, my original intent of working with women, I need to follow that pursuit. And so I finished up my fourth season at Black Roses and then announced that I was leaving. and did not know exactly what I was going to do next. It was not planned out. I just said, I'm going to organically, you know, see what it is that I need to put my energy into. And so I decided that the thing that made sense to me was to start hosting pop-up runs for women only. And so I started hosting them, and I called it Girls Run With Me. So it was really just that I invited people to come out. I put together like an email blast of every woman that I knew, whether they were a runner or not. And I just blasted out these invites for people to come out and come for a run. And so I think the first one that I did, like 18 people showed up, and I was surprised. Like, I hadn't, didn't know if people would really be into it, or if women want to just do like a women's only run. And so the reaction was actually really positive. And we ran together. I kept doing those runs, and for about like 3 months, before we had an opportunity, sometime around International Women's Day, we would do, I had been hosting a run through Nike at that time. And I think they had announced they were doing a race in Toronto. That was the women's race. And so I ended up just with the women that were coming out to run with me. I put together a team for this 15K race. And I said, like, let's train as a team and we'll go out and do this race together. And so that's when I named it Girls Run NYC. And it's been Girls Run since then. And now, you know, we're coming up on our 2 year, I guess it'll be our 2 year anniversary of actually being Girls Run NYC. But it's 2 years and change of when I started doing the women's only runs. And so we have like a core of about 30 women who would consider themselves like members of Girls Run. And then we have probably 150 women who rotate in and out.
Wow.
Yeah.
So like now, do you feel now that you're in a space with what you have with Girls Run that, or Girls Run NYC, that you've now settled into this space that you kind of wanted to be in when you originally had this idea to start up Black Roses?
Yes, I think so. Although, to be honest, it's like a hybrid, because I think Black Roses was like really necessary because I needed to like have that training experience of kind of training really competitively. And, you know, it was like super valuable, like learning experience coming out of Bridge Runners, which was one style of leadership. And then Black Roses was another style of leadership. And then kind of learning from both of those and landing on Girls Run, which I think Girls Run is kind of a hybrid of what I was doing with Bridge Runners and Black Roses. And so, I feel like this is where I should be right now. It feels really good to be doing a women's only project, which I was nervous about, at first. Yeah. And, it feels like the timing is right for it. I got my track and field coaching certification after I left Black Roses, actually. And so a lot of the work I do has gone back to track based with the girls. And that also resonates with me. So, I feel like I'm on this journey. I'm like on the right path.
That's awesome. And you're on this journey, and that kind of like segues perfectly into, and I don't know if you've heard the podcast before, we always get to a point And we want to know, just open-endedly, it can mean whatever you want, but what is your truest adventure in running? Because what you just said is amazing. I'll just, whenever you catch it in your head, you can just interrupt me, but I'll stall to give you a little time. But your truest adventure in running that you're thinking about is going to be phenomenal, because you've had one of the more remarkable lives in running that I have heard. I mean, you've been there from the beginning with Bridge Runners, the creator of Black Roses, creator of Girls Run NYC. I mean,
you know what it reminds me of? Not that this, like, the phenomenalness of your life and career in running, Jesse, needs an analogy, but it, like, as you were talking, it reminds me a lot of, like, Dr. Dre. How many different phases did he have that he started? He was the first one operating in the space, knocks it out of the park, and it's like, oh no, this isn't a good space. I'm going to go do this other thing, and then continues to crush it there afterward.
That's cool. Just rocking those big headphones.
That's it.
Well, I would love to consider myself to be like Dr. Dre. That is a huge compliment. Yeah, I mean, I think for me, that is the truest adventure, is to follow the sort of organic nature of where running takes you. And I think that I feel that way in my professional life and in my personal life, which is that, you know, it's going to always evolve, and you're always going to feel like something is missing, maybe. And I'm going to always look for how to create that thing that might be missing. So I guess for me, it's like, you know, trying to listen to my gut and really do that more, which I think I've done more now than ever. And if there's a gap, or if there's something missing, is like looking for what is needed.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, Jesse, we super appreciate your time. But before we close out, I want to make sure that our listeners know all of the different ways that they can get in touch with you. They can see your work. They can check out Bridge Runners, Black Roses, Girls Run NYC, all of the handles. Do you want to run through your Instagram, Twitter, Facebook handles for us, just so that we'll of course put it when we launch the episode, but that's so folks can hear it here too.
Sure. So I'm pretty easy. I am on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and Strava, Jesse Zappo. And it's just all one word, JESSIEZAPO. And yeah, you can follow me in all of those different ways. Girls Run NYC is also on Twitter and Instagram, and that's just straight Girls Run NYC.
Literally, that noise you heard, Jesse, was as you were saying these, I picked up my cell phone to start to add and friend request on all of these, and then I guess some music that I had like queued up for whatever point in life just starts playing.
Was it Dr. Dre?
Right? I wish it had been, because that would have been perfect. It's like, this guy's plugging Dr. Dre and Dre doesn't even know who he is.
I know.
But sorry, please continue so I can continue to put them down. I've now stopped the music.
No problem. Yeah, so Girls Run NYC is just straight on Instagram and Twitter. And then you can follow Black Roses, which is Black Roses NYC, also on Instagram. And definitely follow Bridge Runners. They're a great one to follow. It's just straight Bridge Runners on Twitter and Instagram. And you could also go to my website, jessiezappo.com.
Yeah, and guys, definitely check out her website. I was checking out Jessie's website earlier. It's like really well put together and includes a lot of like dope information about you and all the different projects that you're involved in.
Hold on, I'm on your website right now. Did you take all these photos?
I did.
Hey, so this whole like art thing, that's real deal.
It's real. I like taking photos.
So, well, on behalf of Quest and myself, anytime you want to come down and shoot some photos in New Orleans, let us know. And anytime you want to come to New Orleans and bring any of Girls Run NYC, that would be awesome. We'd love for you guys to come down here. And I'll just reiterate what Quest said already, which was super thankful for the time that you've given us this evening.
Yeah, thank you, Jesse.
Thank you, guys. I'll definitely hit you up. I'd definitely love to come back down to New Orleans.
Well, thank you, Jesse. And with that, I'm Trey.
I'm Quest, and this has been the Truest Adventure.